The following podcast is a production of Institutional Real Estate Incorporated. For the most comprehensive industry news and information, visit our website at irei.com and sign up for our free daily news alerts.
Welcome to the Dorman Report. It is November 2019. We're moving towards another New Year's, Jeff. And as usual, you've been making the rounds with events, both our events and other parties' events, including our I3 conference, Institutional Investing in Infrastructure, which was held in, I believe, Toronto this year. Is that correct?
No, actually, this was the board meeting. The VIP was held in Toronto, but the board meeting was held in Chicago this year.
Ah, okay. So what do you have for us on that meeting? What were some of the highlights?
Well, I think the most interesting thing was how sophisticated the group has become. When we first started doing these institutional investing and infrastructure meetings, first VIP, and then we did the publication, and then we did the board meeting. The conversations were very, very basic, you know, focused much more on what is infrastructure, what are the different kinds of infrastructure, what are the investment characteristics of infrastructure. And the dialogue today is a lot more sophisticated. People are talking about everything from, you know, ESG implications and impacts to, you know, still there is some dialogue still going on about,
the blocking and tackling.
No,
the basics.
Definitional issues, you know, what really is infrastructure? Because like with any other asset class, you know, the definitions tend to expand over time. So, for example, is maritime considered to be infrastructure? You could argue that it's infrastructure for the transportation of logistical goods, therefore it should be considered infrastructure. Other people would say it's not fixed and it's not monopolistic, so maybe it shouldn't fit in. Aeronautics is another area, you know, aviation aircraft, things of that nature. So, you know, there's still some dialogue around that, but not a lot. It's much more focused on other issues. One of the hot topics that continues to persist is the dramatic need for a benchmark. There's been some attempts. There's a group out in Asia that is working on developing a benchmark. IPD at one point in time was working on developing a benchmark. It was a little bit Australia-centric, which limited its utility, but it was at least creating a model that could have been expanded to other regions. Not sure where they are right now in terms of working on that. But I think eventually when there's a demand for something like that, eventually somebody will step up and fill the gap. People need it for asset allocation purposes. People need it for benchmarking the performance of their own portfolios. And people need it for attribution analysis, all the things that people are using benchmarks in the real estate sector for. So that was a big part of the discussions that came up.
Interesting. So what the sophistication, the increase in the sophistication, what do you attribute that to? Is it simply that people have been at it longer, or do we have different players at the seat, at the seats on the board? What accounts for the increased level of sophistication?
Well, I think it's definitely that people have a lot more experience. You know, when we first started, a lot of people in the U.S. didn't really understand what infrastructure was. And funds were starting to move in the direction of organizing to put together infrastructure programs, but a lot of funds didn't have infrastructure investment programs, so they were just getting started. And so what they were doing is collecting information and sharing information and learning from each other. Now you've got varying levels of experience. Certainly the Canadians started earlier than the U.S. investors did, and so did the Europeans and the Australians. Asians, it had been pretty much the province of government as opposed to private capital, and that continues to be a good portion of what gets done. Certainly there's private-public partnerships that are getting done in Asia, but the main governments, certainly China and India, have diverted a lot of public money towards the development of better infrastructure because they really see it as an investment, not an expenditure. They see it as investing in their economy and that there's an economic return on every dollar that they spend. I think the U.S. feels the same, but we've got such a polarized situation in Congress and so many distractions that even though the last three administrations have made infrastructure a high priority, there hasn't been a heck of a lot accomplished in terms of coming up with a real infrastructure policy or meaningful infrastructure spending campaigns and programs. So all of this is still in flux, is still developing. Meanwhile, the private sector is trying to step up and fill the gap. So
well,
that's part of what's going on.
Is that, yeah, we've talked, I think, in the past about the fact that there's a lot of money that wants to play in infrastructure, but they have not been able to find a place for it. Is that getting better? I mean, you mentioned that the yes, we have the divide in Congress, but then you also have cities and states that make decisions on infrastructure. Are the public-private partnerships starting to assert themselves in a bigger way than in the past?
Well, one of the topics they talked about at the board meeting was the fact that there hasn't been a lot of capital, even private capital, focused on the development of new infrastructure, ground-up greenfield development. And people are nervous about that. There's a lot more risk, just like there is risk in real estate development, right? So people have been reluctant to channel a great deal of capital in that direction. And that's where most of the need is, right? So instead, what they've been doing, and this is what they talked about at the board meeting, is they've been trading assets. So everybody's buying and selling the same assets back and forth or similar assets back and forth. And that isn't creating any new infrastructure. It's simply changing who owns it and how it's capitalized. Now, theoretically, you would think if a public agency were selling off a concession to operate an infrastructure asset like an airport or toll road or something of that nature, that the capital freed up from that was invested in that project is now free to be able to divert into new ground up development of new infrastructure assets. But there hasn't been a lot of that happening. So what's really needed is to get energized around ways of creating programs that appeal to investors that will help us develop the new kinds of infrastructure that we need. And all you have to do is be a global traveler to see the difference. The U.S. in the 50s was way ahead of the curve because the Eisenhower administration recognized from a national security standpoint that building a national international highway system and investing in airports and port properties and water infrastructure and things of that nature was really important from a national security standpoint. So a lot of money went into those programs. But since that time, we've gotten further and further and further behind. And increasingly what's happening in America, too, is a larger and larger portion of public funding is going to pay interest on the national debt, which continues to grow and expand and probably is, according to some people would argue, there's no way that it's ever going to get paid back. So what that means is if it's never, ever going to get paid back, it's either going to be rolled with kicking the can down the lane forever. The problem with that is it continues to grow and accumulate, or we'll end up in a default position at some point in time. So that in itself isn't sustainable. Nobody seems to have the political will to address that issue. And our current president doesn't seem to have a problem with defaulting. He's done it in business many times. So I don't know. I don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah, it's depressing when you think about it, and it seems to be happening all over the world. So I guess at some point,
well, what's depressing is there's a solution to this, right?
Yeah, it's not like we don't know what the answer is.
Well, we do know what the answer is. We're just not. We don't have the consensus and the political will to take the steps and actions that are needed to be taken to resolve it,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, it's not like there isn't money available for doing these things. There's a lot of private money, probably more private money than can be deployed circling around the infrastructure space. Again, the problem is most of that money has been raised for programs that are not oriented towards bottom-up greenfield development. And that's where the real need is more than anything else. I mean, yes, there's a need for retrofitting and repairing existing aging infrastructure. And a lot is needed to be able to do that. But some of that doesn't need to be repaired. It needs to be replaced. And that goes back to, again, ground up greenfield type development. So anyway, those
are some for instance, water systems. I mean, the water systems being one, I mean, what do we do? Retrofit old pipes? I mean, it does seem that that's just put an entirely new water system in place rather than try. I mean, we saw what happened in New Jersey. We saw what happened in Flint, Michigan. I mean, and it's going to happen in other places. It's pretty clear unless something's done.
Well, I've heard it said by a number of different futurist type people who think about what's coming down the pike is that the next world war will be fought not over land and territory, but over water. So that's interesting. The counter position to that is there's a lot being done on the technology side of the ledger to develop new ways of developing water resources. So it may not get as dismal as that. But if you straight line it and just assume things continue on the way they are, population growth is going to outstrip our ability to supply fresh water to that population. And that creates crisis. And when crisis comes up and people can't settle the differences amicably, oftentimes they pick up a rifle and try to solve it that way. Can we go back for a second and I just touch on some of the themes that were important?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Some of the things that people were talking about were just general themes like market correction. Is that coming? Geopolitical factors like trade wars and other geopolitical concerns like Brexit. Certainly risk management is on people's minds as we start to get later in the cycle. And then just lessons learned. You know, people were asking, what do you wish you knew when you first started investing in private infrastructure that you know now but didn't know then? And then from a portfolio standpoint, people were thinking about the role of infrastructure and has it met their expectations? And are those expectations for their portfolios changing? And if so, in what way? And is cash yield becoming more important than IRR as people gain more experience? What are the expectations that people have in terms of allocation infrastructure as an asset class for the coming 1 to 5 years? And where do they foresee the most growth? And U.S. investors, Canadian endowments, where does infrastructure belong within an investor's asset allocation? With respect to private equity, real estate, could this change over time? People talked about operations and management. You know, what are the top three concerns investors had from an organizational perspective over the next 5 to 10 years? And how do investors see these problems being addressed over that time frame? And what have been the biggest successes or disappointments that they've experienced in their portfolios? Again, benchmarks, really important topic. A lot of talk about that at the meeting. Very lively discussions.
How are benchmarks really possible when you've got so many different types of infrastructure? Are they just talking about an amalgam of all of that? You just put it all together. And I mean, you're talking about a lot of, when you really break it down, there's a lot of different types of infrastructure.
Well, yes. And the way they handled that at NCREIF is they came up with, first of all, a NCREIF property index. And then that index could be sliced and diced and analyzed in terms of its components. So there was retail, there was industrial, there was apartments, there was office, you know. So you had sectors that you could say, we know how the apartments are performing and how the industrial performing and that sort of thing. Then they came up with the idea that it's great to have these property indexes and know how properties are performing individually. So if we want to benchmark within the portfolio at the property level, we've got the tools to do it. But we really didn't have a good tool to benchmark portfolio to portfolio. So they came up with Odyssey, which was the open-ended diversified property fund index. And you had to be an open-ended fund. You had to have a certain size. There are other criteria that you had to meet. But the whole idea is that if you could create an index based on a conglomeration of all of those open-ended funds, that you'd have billions and billions and billions of assets to look at, and the blended portfolios would kind of mirror what the portfolio that I might have constructed. Or perhaps the portfolio I constructed was intentionally designed to veer off in some way from Odyssey. Maybe I was overweight apartments and underweight office, or maybe I have no retail, or I overweighted retail or whatever. And then I could then explain that to a certain extent, my outperformance or underperformance was related to how I was exposed to those differences between the Odyssey. And so that became a really useful tool. And most people in real estate today, if they benchmark off that. And since a lot of the real estate investment officers are compensated based on some formula related to beating the benchmark, it's become something that really does drive investment performance and investment decision-making. I think the same thing can eventually be done in infrastructure. I mean, there aren't that many different types. I mean, you've got, you know, water, wastewater treatment, you've got water, you know, supply systems, you've got electrical transmission, electrical power plants, you've got ports, you've got airports, you've got toll roads, you've got rail infrastructure. And then you start to run out of ideas, right? I mean, generally.
Well, there's broadband, and there's some people are counting data farms now as infrastructure.
Well, yes,
I think that's a stretch.
But. Well, but this goes back to what I was saying before. You know, there's debates as to whether those are considered to be infrastructure or something else. You could argue that they clearly are infrastructure because they meet some of the criteria. But even if you put those in, it's just another category. It's certainly capable of doing it. But it will all eventually come back to needing to have some kind of portfolio benchmark, which you'll either have to construct from the component benchmarks, or somebody needs to construct a component benchmark that you then can use to evaluate the performance of your own portfolio. All of this stuff is in the future, but you got to remember, when real estate was in its infancy in 1972 and 73 for institutional investors, an index wasn't even a glimmer in anybody's eye yet. That didn't come around until around 1976 when Blake Eagle, was the founder of NCREIF, was meeting with Neil Darling at Chevron, when he asked him as he was leaving the room, you know, do you have a benchmark? And Blake's answer, if I recall right, was something to the order of, we're working on it, with a twinkle in his eye. And of course, they hadn't been working on it, but he realized that they needed to be working on it, so they started working on it right away. It took them from 1976 till 1982 to get it fully up and operational. So these things don't happen overnight. It takes time. You got to get to critical mass. You got to get enough, you know, assets under management to be able to assemble it. And then you got to submit it to the research community to critique it and tear it apart and attack its weaknesses and start moving to incrementally improve it. And one of the weaknesses in the infrastructure space is there is no academic community for infrastructure. Not really. There might be one or two programs in the whole world on infrastructure. There's very few programs on project management. And so, you know, there aren't a lot of academics that are providing academic research to help support the theoretical underpinnings of the development of these kind of benchmarks. And that's a really weak point. I think that will change too. I think eventually what will happen will be the larger, more successful infrastructure investors and investment managers will start to fund programs and, you know, program chairs at universities to create these kind of, you know, degree programs that people can go and get professional credentials to enter into the field. Because right now that's really a missing hole in the industry as well.
You know, you also mentioned expectations and whether they were being met or not. Is that, was there any clarity on that, whether return expectations are being met at this stage?
I think people are feeling really good about what their infrastructure programs have delivered to date. There was a little disappointment after the global financial crisis because the way that the business evolved was they basically took an infrastructure class that lied probably somewhere between real estate and private equity and slapped a private equity structure on top of it. So the fees were too high and the leverage was too high. And when we hit the global financial, and also they were focusing on very inflation and economy sensitive sectors like toll roads and ports, which were very sensitive, and airports, which were very sensitive to economic changes and downturns in train patterns. And so, you know, what happened is you had too high leverage, and all of a sudden the revenue streams from these things started to fall. The coverage of the leverage was in jeopardy. In some cases, they were underwater, and some of these programs collapsed. So people were really unhappy at that point in time. What came out of the global financial crisis was simpler models with lower leverage and less of a private equity fees type structure that looked a little bit more like real estate structure. And since then, people have been really, really pleased with their performance. What they're all doing is what everybody is doing who is investment management in any asset class, which is bracing for the next downturn, which people have been bracing for 5 years, but so far haven't seen. And so every year they feel like they're getting one step closer to that happening, but nobody can predict for certain exactly when it's going to happen.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned NCREIF. You attended the conference. What did you see there? What's the latest?
Well, you know, the most interesting thing I find about NCREIF is the theme at this particular NCREIF conference was globalization and global. And since NCREIF is a U.S.-centric organization, it was really founded by a U.S. consulting firm, Frank Russell and Company, although it's now it's standalone nonprofit, for U.S. fund managers to benchmark U.S. fund investments. It's somewhat provincial in its outlook and what it does. But I don't know of any other asset class other than real estate that has private market benchmarks like this. There's the IPD and a few others around the globe that have been developed over time, but there really aren't any private market benchmarks that anybody accepts with any credibility in the private equity side of the market or the venture capital side of the market. So, it's really something that's quite unique. And what's always striking about NCREIF is how engaged the membership is. You know, if you go to most industry trade associations, about 20% or less of the membership does 80% or more of the work. And I would say at NCREIF, everybody is engaged. Nobody is taking a free ride. There just aren't any free riders. Everybody's engaged on a committee. Everybody's scrambling to try to create value and do work. And the things that they're working on are good things. They're working on refining the indices, refining the data collection processes, speeding up the data collection processes, automating the data collection processes, improving the attribution analysis that they do, expanding their reach to cover encompass things like senior housing, student housing, mortgage lending programs, and mortgage investing, debt investing, debt real estate. So they're working on a lot of different fronts to improve the benchmarking. And then they have this wonderful integration with the academic community that's constantly working to provide oversight, academic research, and academic criticism that works together to try to make things better. It's just a very, very interesting group, and it's different than any other real estate group I go to. You know, when you go, the people you're interacting with are the people that do most of the back office work of these organizations. They're not buying, they're not selling, but they're portfolio managers, they're accounting people, they're reporting people, they are compliance people, they are in-house counsel, and it's an interesting mix of really high intellect people, again, who are doing most of the work and most of their organizations back home. There's also a nice mix of investors who are actively engaged, although it'd be great to see more investors get more involved.
Why was the theme of this one global? Is there any particular – I mean, it actually, ironically, is happening right at a time when there's this fight against globalization, although real estate, you know, is a little different because money moves and you can buy and sell. But why did they pick global as the theme?
Well, a certain percentage of the people who who, or the investment management firms who are members of NCREIF are managing global mandates. It's just I think when I did my opening comments, I gave some statistics to it. Hold on one second. Let me see if I can pull those up real quick.
Mm-hmm.
In our fund tracker database, we have about 61% of the members or the investment managers in our fund tracker database are U.S.-based managers, and about 39% are offshore investors. So you've got 838 U.S., 538 non-U.S. investment managers. Of the U.S. firms, 17 have global international funds, 63 have global funds, 47 have international funds, and 7 under 9, or 85%, don't have any global offerings at all. So it's about a little less than 25% of the firms are operating global, and yet the portfolios are pretty massive that they're managing. Also, amongst the 709, probably 25% of those are actually active raising money globally. So thinking about global, thinking about global impacts, it wasn't all about global investing either. Part of it was about what are the global issues that are facing all of us, likely to have impact on the performance of our U.S. investment offerings as well. So, I think it was pretty timely for them to be able to do it. You know, global is now has about 20 years under its belt. That would be equivalent to looking at NCREIF in 1996. So it would be an appropriate time to look back and think, what have we accomplished over that period of time? I think that was the kind of theme. We've been doing this globally over time, and what have we learned? What are the implications? How have we performed? All those questions were put on the table. So we kicked it off, actually, with a panel discussion consisting of, you know, Tom Lee, who's the executive director and CIO of New York State Teachers, Matthew Johnson, who's executive director and regional portfolio manager for UBS, and then Dave Bradford, who is the retired former head of global client service for PGIM, also former portfolio manager for PGIM. So we had a broad range of viewpoints to talk about what they've done, how the business evolved, how people first got involved in global investing, and where they're currently exposed in those markets, and what did they learn from all that experience? So it was a pretty fascinating discussion.